Hello. It must be Tuesday, 3 p.m. because you're listening to the Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. I'd like to, at the top of the show, thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch. It's the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and finished beef. Since 1865, Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of Central California coast. The result? Beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more info, go to www.hearstranch.com. My guest today, Catherine Kramer of callmecat.com and Zach Denfeld of Genomic Gastronomy.
Hello.
Hello. We're steaming in this little stevedore, shipping container of a studio behind Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. But we're going to have a good talk. We're going to have a good discussion. Actually, met Catherine on a rooftop in Brooklyn at a friend's birthday party recently, and was told that we had to meet because they had gone to the Royal College of Art in London together, and Kat was working on kind of interactions, design interactions, but more so food-related design interactions. And the one that kind of caught my ear, as it were, was a cloud project where she was modifying an ice cream van in an experiment to make clouds snow ice cream. And I'm just going to let her go because, I mean, it's absolutely fascinating and salivating at the same time. So do tell what the impetus or idea behind this project was.
Right. So it started with an interest in... actually, bizarrely, in nanotechnology, which was from that, it was a friend of mine and I, Zoe Papadopoulou, and we thought, how will nanotechnology influence our future, and what sort of interventions will we see? And then we were looking at kind of domestic uses for or like where it's already been implemented within a domestic setting, came across the opposite end of the scale, which is geoengineering. So basically trying to manipulate the entire Earth's climate to stop global warming.
Yeah, it's just a small task.
Right? Yeah. and so nanotechnology on the opposite end of the scale is basically 10 to the power of minus 9. So very, very tiny. You can't see it.
Yeah.
So how do you maybe experience that? And we came across a technique which... that demonstrated the nanoscale, which was so-called nano ice cream, which is freezing an ice cream base with liquid nitrogen. And the point is the ice crystals don't get a chance to grow beyond the nanoscale, so it results in a very smooth, fluffy texture, but also maybe helps you experience the nanoscale through taste and, you know, other sensory experience of the nanoscale. So that's where it started. And then, yeah, with the geoengineering aspect, we thought, oh, well, what if we can make cloud snow ice cream? Because there's already a number of quite bizarre and preposterous proposals, which are very, you know, very serious and put forward by serious scientists.
Yeah, but I mean, so it's based on an idea in, like, I mean, as early as I think the 1920s to 1940s cloud seeding, where they'd shoot, you know, silver iodide and dry ice, pretty much, hoping to make it rain.
Precisely. And I mean, weather modification's been sort of, you know, one of man's desires since before anything.
Yeah. It's the beginning of time.
Yes. Yeah. You know, rain dances and whatever. So we are the newest iteration of that type of work.
Yeah. And the website for that project specifically is thecloudproject.co.uk.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just wanted to throw it out there for all you guys to check out.
Yes.
Zach, on the other hand, I think works sometimes on a bigger, broader scale. Not to say that, you know, geo versus nano isn't you know, a gamut. But what's interesting about Zach's work is the Brinjal four-way, which was a kind of collaborative amongst students in India to have this cooking competition where they'd source Brinjal, more commonly known as eggplant.
As eggplant, yeah. Actually, there's a variety of names in India, used local names. And yeah, so I was teaching at a school called Srishti School of Art and Design in India, where I teach half the year. And when I got there this last time, there was this big debate happening over whether India wanted to allow Monsanto's new crop, which was a BT eggplant, into the country.
Yeah.
It was pretty contentious. And so the students wanted to look at it. I wanted to look at it. And so what we realized was that one of the big concerns around accepting this GM technology is it might adversely affect the agricultural biodiversity. And then it turns out that me and my students had no idea what the agricultural biodiversity was like.
Yeah.
So we just, like, the first thing we're like, okay, well, let's just go to the markets and see what's there.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even tell you that half the stuff was eggplants, because there's long, thin white ones, long green ones. There's these little ones that have, like, spikes all over the spine.
Ooh, yeah.
So just, like, in 2 hours of visiting different markets in Bangalore, we found eight varieties.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of a celebration of the, you know, current agricultural biodiversity and what's available. And then it was also about trying to sort of reclaim some of the recipes from their youth they remembered from their grandparents making.
Yeah.
And so as their, like, mothers have entered the workforce, they're not cooking at home as much, and there's maybe a discontinuity with these recipes. But just to make sure it wasn't too conservative, we also wanted to look at sort of innovation. So one of the groups made candied brinjal, which was sort of like eggplants with, like, lemon and caramel on the outside.
Yeah.
So, like, you know what else? You know, it's about conservation and innovation.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we had this, there's this great alternative space in Bangalore downtown, and we had this huge cooking contest. 16 different teams came out with recipes. You know, we had three winners.
Yeah, and I just saw a little Vimeo video recently of that, you know, compilation. But what's also very interesting is the idea of you not knowing what's in those markets, what is actually, you know, indigenous of the area, mm-hmm. and then deciding that that's not enough, that Monsanto said, well, we have to bring in these, you know, GMOs in a sense, because there's not enough native variety. Or do they even have that in consideration?
Monsanto. You know, I think they were basically looking at, we want to enter this market because so far India hasn't accepted any edible GMOs. They've accepted cotton.
Yeah.
And so I think, I mean, Monsanto, as far as I can tell, is basic cost benefit. What's the one crop that's sold all over the country? And eggplant is one thing that every different ethnic and religious and local community has recipes for. And so I think that was their consideration. And I think it actually really backfired in terms of their hopes for entering that market, because it caused such anger in so many different communities.
Yeah.
Whereas if they had picked, like, a smaller plant, and I always give the example of bitter gourd, which a lot of people don't like the taste of.
Yeah.
They may have had found more success in entering the market. But yeah, that's something I'm trying to find more about. I mean, part of it is a lot of the companies entering the space don't exactly promote the debate that much, because it's not to their advantage.
Yeah.
And a lot of the debate happens in languages other than English, which my students may or may not have access to. So Hindi or local Kannada. So it's a pretty complicated debate to begin with, and then to have to deal with all these different languages.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes quite a thing to get into. So that's why we thought, okay, well, just doing this cooking thing and finding these recipes and the varieties, it's a way in for us. And we get to taste it and touch it and talk to farmers and talk to vendors. And
yeah,
that was our way in. So I think we're, you know, continuing to look at where this can go, because it's not off the table. The government temporarily put a moratorium on it, but they're going to reconsider it after more testing is done. So,
yeah.
You know, it's there.
You know, it's an interesting corollary to another project that you're working on, the vegetarian bouillabaisse, which was taking the kind of, well, you can explain it better, but the combination of a tomato with a fish gene to be able to create not just a fish tomato, but this super tomato that would be able to, you know, stay on shelves, last longer, taste better, be brighter. And
right. So, well, this company, DNA Plant Technology, actually tried to make this in the early 90s. And so it's sort of, that was one of the vegetables. You know, I was a kid, so I don't remember this, but that was one of the products that got a lot of consumers very anxious in America. And, you know, one of the concerns was, oh, if you take this fish gene from the Arctic flounder and you put it in a tomato, will I get sick if I have a seafood allergy?
Yeah.
And which shows some misunderstanding of the science, because it, you know, it's a small insertion of a transgene which doesn't code for the protein that people are allergic to. But, you know, on the other hand, there are a lot of concerns about, like, let's say, intellectual property. What does it mean that this company owns this new product and you have to, you know, sort of use their intellectual property agreement? And so the idea was that it has this gene from this fish which is frost tolerant. So if this plant worked well, you could put it in the ground, let's say, in March, and if a frost came early in New England, it would survive that. And you know, when you wouldn't lose all your plants.
Yeah, and I'm sure the vegetarian debate came out too.
Exactly. And it was really funny because I was doing this research in India, and there's a great article by a Buddhist who was like, "Well, as a Buddhist, I don't really have any problem with this."
Yeah.
So that was pretty interesting. So I'm definitely going to invite Buddhists to come to my vegetarian bouillabaisse dinner when it happens.
You know. Which you can serve with the community meat labs, victimless meat. Kat has been working on this idea that explores how emerging food-related technologies could be applied outside of the industrial food system, namely in vitro meats that are, well, not meatless, but victimless. Could you explain a little bit more about that?
Well, that project started by looking at in vitro meat as a sort of, like, it's claimed that that's going to be a way of solving the you know, problems with the meat industry as is today.
Because yeah.
There's all, like, a number of reasons why it's problematic. but there's not really very many ways to deal with that if you're a meat eater. So, and, you know, there's sort of statistics that are saying that the global consumption of meat is increasing instead of decreasing. So how do we then deal with that? And then one of the ways that people are thinking about it is, for example, to grow meat in a lab as opposed to, so you'd only grow the cells that you'd need, for example, you know, a steak or something. There's a lot of, within that technology, there's still a lot of problems that's still in sort of early stages. But I thought then they've already successfully grown, you know, very small
globs of jelly.
Globs of jelly, basically.
Doesn't that sound so appetizing?
I mean, there's a lot of problems with it. But for example, how do you exercise these cells? Which is also an interesting question. Like, and but yeah. So I thought, well, since it's so early on in this process of development, maybe it's an interesting point which we can consider alternative ways for it to enter our food system or the market. And is there room for science in our domestic setting or in our, you know, with all the kind of community-based food networks that we're seeing pop up, like Grow at Home, Grow Local.
Sustainable.
Sustainable. All these wonderful. Exactly. How, like, can you introduce scientific kind of techniques into this realm?
So, I mean, the odd thing, though, is how do you introduce that to a food chart, a food system? And Zach had worked on a food chart specifically, which shows how food is represented in government databases. And is there a place for... I mean, I hate to call them GMOs, but in a sense, they are. I mean, or do you find them to be some other kind of term or, acronym?
Well, this is a conversation that we've been having, which Zach's been saying, like, oh, we've been biohackers. We've always been biohackers. Yeah. And,
I mean, I don't want to overstate the case because I think there's a lot of problems with the technology, not so much from the level of molecular or genetic, but from the way that it's researched, the funding, the intellectual property regimes. And those are hugely problematic. Mm. In terms of the tech itself, it's a technique, you know, and this is the case I've been trying to make to all of my peers. Like, transgenic organisms are just like permaculture, and they're just like phytoremediation, and there's good and bad things with those technologies. So, not to discount that it may be a somewhat of a discontinuity, but it, in some ways, it's just another type of biotechnology like seed saving. And so if you start to approach it that way, I think you can be more critical and thoughtful with your engagement with industry. Because part of my challenge has been, as an artist, you know, when I engage with scientists and I say, oh, well, my friends are very concerned about GMOs and playing God, and are they going to get sick with the seafood allergy? Their ears basically shut off.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to talk to you anymore because they're like, well, they don't understand the molecular biology. But once, you know, I come and I've done my homework and I've spent some time in a molecular biology lab and I said, I understand this technology. Here are my concerns. And they're largely about eco-regional, you know, consolidation of food chains, intellectual property, some unproven possible side effects on humans, but particularly the way they affect, ecosystems. Then they're like, oh, well, cool, we'll talk to you. But yeah, I think there's a room for For biotech of all different types. And what I'm trying to really push is to say that this control of biotech needs to be in the hands of local communities. And that's a conversation I haven't seen happen yet. So what is it to happen instead of, let's say, Monsanto or Cargill having a product that they own and sell rights to use? What if it's a community that has a local cultivar? So, for example, in South India, they have a very particular kind of eggplant that they use.
Yeah.
Now, a blight's coming. It's going to wipe it out. My sort of idea is that they could send it to the state-run hack lab. The state could send it back with a genetically modified version, and you would definitely know it was theirs because it's their cultivar. It looks different. It's phenotypically different. There are obviously still concerns about horizontal gene transfer and all those things, but at least that way you're retaining the genetic diversity. And all of the work that those I'd call them biohackers have done for 1,000 years to get to this cultivar. So, you know, I'm trying to explore this possibility, but then it's about who do you talk to?
Exactly.
You know, so that's been the last few months is finding, you know.
Yeah. People, so we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back talking about whether it's better to sustain local ecology or make mass efficiency. You've been listening to The Food Scene. This is Michael Harlan Turkel. Hey, this is Michael Harlan Turkel. You're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. Guest today, Kat Kramer, Zach Denfeld. We were just talking about the idea of local ecology versus mass efficiency. And what came up, I had recently been reading some articles about eliminating processes, making things more efficient. You have a recipe. It says skin a carrot. Why not have skinless carrots? Why not, before, you know, putting it through a machine, have the product ready? So whether or not to apply technology to the base or apply technology to the mode, is that an interesting debate that comes up within, you know, trying to create these nouveau GMOs, which aren't, you know, bad for you, but actually good for the greater society?
I'm not so sure, because I think that's just encouraging laziness. And you know, I think that GMOs or these technologies should be considered when this is also contestational, but when they can be of some sort of benefit to someone, whether that's, you know, a frivolous benefit or not.
Yeah. Then.
But, yeah, so, for example, pre-peeled carrots, which I kind of find it horrifying. All the packaged foods you get in the supermarket here, it's like pre-sliced, pre-everything.
Oh, yeah.
And it's...
We
it's
should say she's from Norway. Yeah. So that's just a, if you're wondering
but
the context.
You get it in Norway, too, now. I mean, you know, your biggest export is your cultural... anyways. but yeah, I think it's problematic. It's a mind shift. And instead of saying, oh, we should improve the technologies and have skinless carrots, we should be saying, well, actually, no, get a peeler and peel your carrots.
I mean, I want to temper that too. I mean, I would generally agree, except that, you know, I'm seeing, like, spending time in India, this transition from, you know, sort of this pre-industrial economy to this highly industrialized economy where women are entering the workforce. They want to feed their children well. They don't have a lot of time. And I want to be realistic about sort of both citizens and consumers make that distinction, choices. So I do understand the need for time saving if you don't have a multi-generational household like you used to, and all of a sudden you still want to feed your kids. You know, I think there's some need for that if that's the decision the family's making, that, you know, I said
but it's a larger food culture debate as well then, because it's the more these efficiency, the more efficiently you can buy your meals, such as TV dinners, whatever, it cuts out this sort of cultural relationship we have to food, which is very important in having a healthy food system.
At the end of the day, for me, like so many of the things in biology and agriculture, I'm finding have nothing to do with biology or agriculture and have to do with capital.
Yeah.
and you know, the industrial mindset and, you know, industrial food systems. I think that's what we're seeing in this country, is that there's this need for connection to foods, whether it be through the mediation of the farmer or the butcher. You want those social connections with your food. And so no addition of processing offsite where you don't see it does that. And so there's a reverse market in the U.S. where people want to actually peel their own carrots and want to talk to their butcher and don't mind spending an hour. But that means that we need
choice.
Well, there should be a choice, but that also the economy affords that kind of time for food prep and spending money on quality foods. And we just have spent the last, you know, 60 years dismantling that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a long road. But I think for me, the major part of my project with genomic astronomy is to say we've spent 50 years using efficiency as the main driver and selection mechanism of the food system. That doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
What are the other things we need to take into consideration? You know, ecosystem health. Do non-humans like your garden or your farm? If bumblebees aren't coming to your farm, or, you know, honeybees, you know, if the rabbits don't like it, then...
Yeah, there's been this shift in paradigms from product to byproduct. Mm. You know, like secondary, tertiary, things that happened. And it is a cause and effect that I think it got to a point where it's kind of like following a recipe. There is a start, there is an end. But realizing that it's more cyclical than that, which leads me to want to talk about CATS, Urban Grazing Project, which does speak of waste in a very interesting way. And by lessening it, she was disposing of food by presenting the excess to the public in a very intriguing way.
So just to explain briefly, it was a very quick experiment to see how I could personally deal with excess food, because I was living alone at the time, and all that the supermarket would offer, well, not all, but a lot of the time it was, you know, bagged like mandarins or, you know, grouped items, and I'd never get through them all by the time they'd go bad. So I decided to hang excess food that still tasted good out of my window for passersby to sort of...
How high up was this
collect.
One?
Second story. Yeah. So
there was just this dangling box.
Yeah, there was a dangling box creating a little sort of spectacle for bypassers, which they seemed to enjoy. I was also secretly monitoring them. bit of a little big brother thing. So I kind of did that to see if there is room for people to, you know, to kind of deal with the sort of waste aspects of their consumption, but personally, instead of, you know, relying on massive changes for this to happen.
Did you get stuff back in the box? Like, were there gifts and notes? And
there was no gift. There was a note. Actually, no, there wasn't a note, but I made a website for it, which is terrible. But I made a website for it, and there was somebody went and wrote a note on the website saying, thanks for the... I can't even remember what he had. But so, like, I only did it for a week. So it's a very, very short test. And the first day, I, you know, lured them in with easy to digest things. So,
like how you said the word Mandarin. Lure them in rather than just saying let them in.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had chocolate biscuits and I had, oranges and tangerines, I think. And then I was like, okay, I'm not going to waste my money buying stuff to get people to take this. So then I had some old onions, which were about to go off, and I put a lemon in there, and sort of things that you can't instantly eat, or I wouldn't, And so...
Oh, I mean, I had an onion and a lemon for lunch today. I bit right into them both.
Yeah, you might have some issues in the bathroom.
That's why I'm on the radio and not interacting with people.
And they were taken as well by the end of the day. So, and I just sort of let it hang there and do its own thing. So I think, you know, as an individual, it's not that interesting. But if you scaled it up and it became sort of an informal system across an entire, what's it called, city or, you know, urban environment somehow, then it could, potentially...
I guess that's where the hope for a lot of these projects for me are, is seeing these sort of peer production networks in action. Mm. And, you know, it's not utopian. It's sort of saying, like, okay, there's these people with different interests. They're connected, let's say, perhaps through IT, cell phones, web, whatever. There's also the sort of material aspect, this basket hanging out of the thing. But then they can maybe agree upon their own specs. So you don't need the FDA to come in and approve your dumpster your dumpster-dived bagels or whatever. But there may be some informal mechanism for how people decide how rotten is too rotten.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot of things we're contending with. Like, you know, if you can't butcher your own meat because, you know, you have to have this inspector come in, like, but you want to be, like, above ground. You don't want to be below ground doing it.
Yeah.
What are the sort of informal self-policing mechanisms? There's some hope there.
So it's more of like a repurposing. So it's saying, well, I can't do this, but I can distribute it to this person. And I mean, there is hope.
But scaling horizontally rather than vertically, right? So it's not like industrial. Yeah. Like, you know, you could take all of the, like, waste food and put it into, like, I don't know, like a burner and burn it for energy or something.
Yeah.
Make that like a municipal service. But this is more like all these little nodes where people informally agree to, like, maybe I have a rotten cheese, but I need rotten onions or whatever. Yeah.
So, I mean, like, are there any share sites like that? I mean, is there a website that people say, well, I have these about to turn, and if anyone needs them, contact me, and no trade necessary.
Like a food version of FreeCycle.
Yeah, exactly.
I think probably the problem with a lot of these networks is so far the scale of networks, right? So to make that viable, you probably need like a certain number of people, but I don't know on the top of my head, but that would be a great for someone out there to make.
Somebody make that.
If it is in the Pacific Northwest, I will join.
Yeah. Are there future projects that you guys are working on right now that you'd like to share?
My big project right now that I'm trying to wrap up is called Glowing Sushi, and it'll be up at glowingsushi.com. And basically, I created a recipe a few months ago called the Not in California Roll, which is basically a California roll replacing the fake crab meat with the glow-in-the-dark fish that you buy at the pet store.
Why don't they ever call fake crab meat real pollock? Or real haddock, you know, what it actually is.
Crab with a K.
Yeah.
So it's called Not in California Roll because you can buy these glow-in-the-dark pet fish everywhere in the U.S. except for California. the company that sells them in the U.S., Yorktown Technologies, originally made them as a pet, but, you know, the street's always going to do its own thing with technology. And I thought, oh, these would be great to eat because they're colorful and, you know, they would glow. So I've been sort of trying to develop these different recipes with them. GF Pizza is another one. Some GFP glow-in-the-dark fish. I didn't feel comfortable about serving it to people at first because I didn't, you know, really have the research. But there's actually a lot of great documents the company provided where they did, like, literature reviews saying, you know, GFP breaks down in the gut of rats. So if a little kid took one of these out of a fish tank and ate it, it'd probably be okay.
Yeah.
So now I feel okay. I'm serving it. So if you want it, let's see. I'll hopefully do some servings too. And so I'm shooting some episodes of a cooking show that has these different recipes. And what I'm trying to get at is that, you know, all these transgenic organisms are coming to the market. In the next year, we're probably going to have transgenic salmon finally hitting the market after 10 years of... and so, you know, how do people feel about that? And then also sort of the pet versus food debate. And then what's really insane to me about this company's product is that you, it says it's illegal to breed them. But if you put them in a fish tank together, they will breed.
Yeah.
So that becomes really interesting. And so I've noticed online there's a lot of just home breeders that are crossing these with other types of zebra danios. And so there's this sort of whole community of biohackers that don't know biohackers.
I love knowing about this underbelly of biohackers breeding glowing fish for sushi right now. So
that's my main thing.
Yeah.
I suppose. Yeah, I've my own projects have been put on hold for a little while because the reason I'm in New York is to help Natalie Jeremijenko, who was just on earlier, out with some of her projects during the summer. So I'm currently working on the Cross Species Adventure Club dinner party, which is coming up on the 21st, and also... helping her with a show that she's curating in DC at the Australian Consulate and various other things.
But what we really want to know is, when is the ice cream cloud truck coming to Brooklyn?
When someone pays for it to be shipped.
Hey, ask for assistance here, because I'm sure plenty of people would be willing to open their wallets and their mouths.
Can you like open source the plans so someone else could do it for you? Just like, here, the plans, go for it. Just put my name on it. Creative Commons.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, it's a fun project. I mean, a large portion of the project was also refurbishing the van, and the main aim of the project was also to have a space which sort of can travel around and sit outside of institutions where you can talk about you know, various emerging technologies and also food and weather modification, whatever that we've had, like a number of different scientists, artists, designers come and speak in the van. And I think that's actually the main element of the project is, small discussions and informal distribution of knowledge.
Yeah, if you'd like to extend these small discussions with Kat or Zach, feel free to contact them. Call me Kat or genomicastronomy.com. Just want to thank you both for being on the show.
Thank you. You've been listening to
The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Michael Harlan Turkel, your host. Every Tuesday at 3, thanks again to Hearst Ranch for sponsoring, to Jack Inslee for producing, Nat Wiener for engineering, and Roberta's for hosting. See you next Tuesday at 3.